You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
Rap Genius. We don't know these rappers. We don't know these aerosol artists. We don't know these dancers. We wouldn't normally hang out with them. But since we're getting paid and this is working out and we got a new audience, what the hell? Let's do it.
Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This episode, we bring you a talk with Michael Holman. Holman is a true hip-hop impresario who's worked in just about every facet of the art form. He managed the New York City Breakers, a breakdance troupe that performed all over the world. He wrote arguably the first book about breakdancing and graffiti. He put on the first live hip-hop reviews in New York City. He was involved in several iconic films, including Beat Street and Downtown 81. He was a musician who worked with Jean-Michel Basquiat in the band Grey, and he's the creator and host of the influential TV show Graffiti Rock, which is now coming up on its 30th anniversary. And that's only the beginning of Holman's career, which we go over in depth in this talk. Holman is currently running a campaign on Kickstarter to raise money for a documentary about Graffiti Rock. What's really incredible about the Kickstarter campaign is some of the rewards include never-before-seen footage from 1980s New York hip-hop. I began my conversation with Holman by asking him about his career-long propensity for teaching about hip-hop culture. As always on Outside the Lines, we bring you a special kind of audio footnote. Every time you hear this sound,
Rap Genius.
Go to rapgenius.com and search for OTL45. There, you'll find audio, video, and more information to bring you further outside the lines. And now, here's our talk with Michael Holman. Welcome to Outside the Lines with Same Old Sean. I'm here with Michael Holman, hip-hop impresario, man of a long career and many different lives and talents. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thanks, Sean.
Of course. So we were looking at your, got you signed up for your verified Rap Genius account today. And one of the first things I showed you was you'd done an album, I think 83, 84 with the New York City Breakers.
Yeah.
And
we did a couple of them with K-Tel.
Yeah. And there was a tune on there called Vocabulary Rap. And I wanted to start with this because I feel like one of the things that you've done your whole career, and especially in the early 80s, was trying to teach people about hip-hop, especially when it was a new culture, both with the TV show you did, which we'll get to in detail, with the album, with the book, traveling internationally. All of those things tend to have this thread in common of trying to teach people about what was then a relatively new culture. And I was hoping you could talk about why that was so important to you.
Well, both my parents had been educators at different times in their lives. Education was always a big deal. Education is power. And I can remember in the early days, you know, as a pioneer of hip hop, we didn't even call it hip hop in the beginning. I mean, that term wasn't really used very often until like well into like 82. Back then, it was very much something that, in my opinion, in my estimation, was not necessarily going to have legs unless it somehow came downtown from the Bronx, where all these things were really starting and were really had a real history and had an audience. It wasn't going to happen unless it came downtown, and the downtown intelligentsia, the downtown club kids, the downtown and international press, unless they understood what it was, it really, I didn't believe it had a chance of really making it past the Bronx.
Yeah.
as a cultural phenomenon, a movement, what have you. And I saw, probably I experienced this firsthand. I can't think of any particular events, but I probably experienced this firsthand a number of times where I wanted to make some event happen or introduce someone to somebody and found that the person or establishment that I wanted to present this idea to or to get their support with in terms of, like, again, bridging these worlds, were like, well, I don't know what this is you're talking about. I don't know why I should have this rapper or DJ or dancers at my club or what have you. Why is this important? And in the process of me explaining why it was important and explaining why this was a big deal, it was probably moments like that that made me realize, wait a second, this phenomenon that's coming from the Bronx that involves dance, that involves DJing and turntablism, that involves, you know, rhymes and rapping and that involves graffiti art or aerosol art, it can appear to an outsider as being disparate, unconnected, not necessarily compelling, frightening because it belongs to a very kind of dangerous and crime-ridden urban area, and off-putting. And until the culture is explained in a way that's put in context with other cultures and that is shown on one end, but then on the other end, its uniqueness is explained, its time and place in history, its origins, and its potential in the future, until you can really explain those things clearly, its anthropological importance and impact, until you can explain that clearly, I found in those early days that there was a lot of people saying, well, what's special about a DJ? I've seen DJs. Well, what's special about somebody talking over a beat? I mean, I've heard of the Last Poets. I don't see anything special about that. I don't get it, Michael. Why are you making such a big deal about this? And so with some of these frustrating moments, over time I realized I've got to package this or explain this in a way that makes it compelling and clear. And that was another major reason why I really saw the importance of making this or presenting this culture in sound bites or in defining terms, et cetera, et cetera. And also a third reason. So one is I had this education background. Two, I needed to sell the culture to other people to help me get it out there to the rest of the world. I really wanted to do that. And the third reason is because one of the first things that I was asked to do by my downtown friends was to write about the culture in the East Village Eye. Leonard Abrams, who was the publisher of the East Village Eye, very important paper, small, unknown today. They're going to be putting out their back catalogs very soon in a book, but a very important newspaper because it was one of the first newspapers in the downtown East Village scene, writing about punk, writing about new wave, writing about the art scene, and writing about hip hop. Leonard Abrams asked me to write. I actually wrote three articles about hip hop culture in the East Village Eye. One of them was an interview of DJ Africa Bambaataa, and that article came out in January 1982. Was the first time the term hip hop was ever published in a newspaper. I didn't make the term up. I didn't coin the term. But I had the honor and the privilege of being the first person to write the term hip-hop in print, in published print. That was because of the East Village Eye. So I'm already explaining things. In that article, I actually defined hip-hop. In another article, I defined what uptown crew or uptown culture, how they dressed and the terminology that they used and the language that they used and the lexicon of the uptown culture was in the other two articles I wrote for the East Village Eye. Again, they all came out in the same article, in the same magazine, the same publication in January 1982. And it was like just a giant definition of these things. You had to do that. All you had was paper and print. And you didn't have video when you're reading this newspaper. You didn't have someone talking to you about it, someone live. All you had was paper and print. So you had to be very defining. Yeah. And so as being a hip hop early hip hop journalist, I was one of the first. I'm already in the game of defining things.
Okay, that's great. And I think
long winded.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's there's a lot to talk about, and I wanted to kind of take it back with you to the very beginning. I know you're a bit of an army brat growing up.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
I was born and raised in the military up until, you know, well into my adolescence. My father retired when I was like 13 or 12 or 13 and lived all over Europe and the United States. Growing up living in different army and moving every 18 months, it makes you a little neurotic, but at the same time, it gives you like a childhood with a transient childhood in which you end up growing up meeting and coming into contact with a lot of people and a lot of different people. And I've always been, I think, very gregarious and made friends really quickly because you had to, because in 18 months you were gone. Growing up as an army brat and a military brat and living overseas for a lot of my childhood made me very conscious of what was going on in the United States, made me want to move back to the States, made me fascinated by what the things that I would see through the military media, through our TV channels. You know, I'd see Where the Action Is, Fractured Flickers, American Bandstand, Rawhide, and Gunsmoke. And we'd see all the television shows, the cartoons. And we'd see what was going on in the United States that we were kind of not privy to and not didn't really take part of so much. Skateboarding, all these things that, you know, finally getting back to the States by 1966, I just dove into this like mid-60s American cultural explosion that was so much fun. And so and it made me, I think growing up an army brat has made me a real zeitgeist for American and world culture. Really hungry for culture, trying to understand why human, you know, real armchair anthropologist in that respect too. Always hungry to understand why people do the things they do, both in a behavioral way, but also in a cultural way. Like, why do they choose these different things to express themselves in dance and music and style and fashion and language? I think being an army brat is very much part of why I am that way.
And I know before moving to New York, you spent some time in D.C., right?
No, I never lived in D.C.
Oh, okay.
I lived in D.C. 1 year in 1994.
Oh, after
having lived in New York for many years, I was kicked out of New York. I was kicked out by the goddess. Well, you know, New York is a very jealous lover and wants you to love her and spend every dime you have on her. And when you don't have that money to spend on her, she wants you out. And so for 1 year, I had to leave New York and live with my parents in D.C. for a year. But during that year, it was a really interesting time. I was I had already written the screenplay to the film Basquiat that Julian Schnabel directed. And but there was no money because I hadn't raised the money yet to make the film. And so I was broke and I left. And when I went to D.C., I met some really interesting people who didn't really know who Basquiat was. They kind of thought that they believed all the hype that they read in the press, which was half of it was so wrong about him. Jean was upper middle class. Father was a corporate executive. Jean went to private schools, et cetera, et cetera. And they believed the hype that Jean was a ghetto snipe. He would joke about that. Wrote his graffiti was like hip-hop graffiti, lived in the projects in Harlem. I mean, all that's so wrong. And in the process of educating my artist friends in D.C. about who he was, we created this this arts program called King's Court Project, which was a this arts project in which we took kids from the most desperate backgrounds in D.C. and from the worst high schools, five kids, and took them on a journey of like art, an art journey in which we exposed them to the avant-garde in art, not just any art, but the avant-garde in art, and then had them make art. And so, for example, we played like John Cage and Stockhausen music for them, and then allowed them to make music by dropping water drops in water and playing it backwards, and then use it as a soundtrack to like the most avant-garde short films inspired by, you know, La Chandelle, you know, by Buñuel or by you know, the most out there films. And it was called King's Court Project, and it's something that I want to bring back to life one day.
Rap Genius. That sounds like such an incredible experience. So I know you're a painter as well, getting back to the art thing.
Right. I'm a painter. I'm a fine artist. I paint, and one of the things that I focus on in my paintings, the primary thing, my focus on my paintings are deconstructing historical documents, like taking historical documents like papal bulls or flags, like the Confederate flag, and deconstructing them like Jacques Derrida's meaning of taking something and taking it apart and putting it back together again and changing its meaning. And so like when I've done Confederate flags where I've used the Black Panther panther symbol and putting it on a flag that's been rendered in a mock 3D style. I've taken documents like papal, like the Pope's messages to Pope's letters to kings from the, you know, 12th century, and have changed them around and used text. And so I use a lot of text. I use a lot of pop imagery, and the whole idea behind it is to take the meaning of sometimes very destructive and oppressive symbolism and meaning, like the Confederate flag, and turning it around and owning it. Part of that is because I had ancestors who, like, there was about 10,000 Black Confederate soldiers, believe it or not, that fought in the Civil War on the South side, which is such an absurd thing, I know, but it happened in history, and two of my ancestors were Confederate soldiers who were Black, who were actually mixed race, you know, but mulattoes from Texas, East Texas, and they fought in the Civil War on the South side. I actually have all the documentation from their medical benefits, from their retirements from the Civil War, benefits that went to their widows. And I have all these documents from Texas. Texas is like Utah. They collect all this information. And I've made Xerox copies of them and plastered them on my paintings and painted over them. Like Basquiat uses a lot of Xerox images and paints over them. And I've used them in some of these deconstructed Confederate images, which you can see on my website, michaelholman.com. And again, I try to change the message. I try to say, you know, you think you're going to use that flag to oppress me? No, man, that's part of my history. I'm going to own the thing and blow your mind and turn it around and put it on you and say, like, you know, I own this flag. I'm part of this history. I'm as much a part of the history of this country as any white person any day. And my history goes back to the beginnings of this country, and I'm going to own that. That's why some of my paintings have Native on it as well. And I like to blow the minds of like white racists who think they own this country. It's like, no, you know, fuck you. I own this country just as much as you do. And I'm going to prove it through my fine art, through my paintings.
So one of the reasons I wanted to have you come by is you have such a incredibly varied career, kind of at the center of so many forms of what we would later think of as hip hop, you know, and dance and music and all kinds of things. I wanted to ask specifically about the breakdancing side of things for a minute, since we don't cover that much on this show. And I feel like sometimes the dance aspect of hip hop culture is sort of pushed to the side or thought of as a fad or something like that. And I was looking at your book, a little bit of your book, Breaking in the New York City Breakers. And there was this idea in it that I thought was really incredible and fascinating, which is this idea that in a breaking battle, the losers need to be able to admit that they lost, or the whole thing kind of breaks down.
That's interesting. That's fascinating. It reminds me of a battle I witnessed not that long ago, maybe about 4 years ago in the Bronx, between two crews. And I remember that one of the judges was Crazy Legs of the Rocksteady crew. And one crew was from Boston, and another crew was from another place. Another crew might have been from New York. And they were battling, and the crew from Boston was had their turn, and they were battling, and they were dancing to James Brown's Give It Up or Turn It Loose live version, which, as we all know, is a classic B-boy a song to dance to, and it represents B-boying in so many ways. And I'll never forget, there's a moment in the song in which James Brown says, and he has no idea that in the future this is going to mean so much to dancers, clap your hands, bum, 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 stomp your feet, boom, 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 clap your hands, bum, 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 stomp your feet, boom, 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 right? And the crew from Boston, in the excitement of the battle, dancing in front of Crazy Legs, and maybe just because they didn't know, while they were dancing, one of them was dancing, and he was kind of, you know, doing that, clapping his hands when James Brown said so, stomping his feet when James Brown said so. He didn't stomp his feet in the right beat that James Brown says to stomp your feet in. He missed a beat, or he went too long, or he didn't go long enough. And Crazy Legs jumps up and says, ah, that's not what you're supposed to do. That's not the rhythm that goes to. You missed the stomp part. And they instantly, the Boston crew, instantly you could see that they were crestfallen, that they had lost face. And they smiled about it. They didn't take it too seriously. They kind of laughed and smiled about it. But instantly they knew they lost the battle, because they hadn't decoded that song in a way that you should have known that. You should have known. Any B-boy worth their salt should have known. So what comes up, and to address the issue that you brought up specifically, is that there's so much pride in breakdancing and in B-boying, whatever terminology you want to use. There's so much pride in being a breakdancer or being a B-boy, and that pride demands that you pay great respect and homage to the culture, and that you respect the dancers that came before, that you respect the customs and all the different customs and the religion that really is that this is based on, if you want to call it that. It certainly is a religion. And so when this crew recognized that they missed something that they should have known, this one little piece in the James Brown song, when they should have stomped their feet at the right cadence, they recognized that they blew it and they had to come back and try again. And to not say that would have flown in the face of, would have been a reneging or denial of all these different customs, and there would have been chaos. I mean, to avoid chaos, you need to have rules to avoid chaos. And that's part of it, but I think it's something greater than that. I think that within these dancers, and they can be from anywhere in the world, these are kids. This is why hip-hop blew up around the world. Hip-hop culture blew up around the world. It offered to kids who really didn't have a voice, working class and poor kids around the world, it offered them a voice by giving them the opportunity to embrace something that they could do. They may not have the money or the education to rise above their station in these cultures that maybe not like America, where you're really stuck in different places, in different socioeconomic groups. It gave them that freedom to be somebody, to be a B-boy, to be a DJ, to be a rapper. And it was the first time that had happened in world culture. That something, and it's not a big surprise it came from America, and it's not a big surprise that it came from New York, and it's not a big surprise that it came from poor and working class blacks and Latinos from the Bronx. They created something that instantly plugged into the same social economic demographic around the world, whether it was in Poland, whether it's in China, whether it's in South Africa, whether it's in England, this culture that's hip-hop said to these kids, hey, we've got something specially for you. Rock and roll didn't do that. Rock and roll did not give those working class kids from the 1960s this same voice that they gave kids in the 1980s and 90s. Instantly, these kids said, wow, I can be a breakdancer. I can be a rapper. I can be a DJ. I've been given something that has not happened as a cultural phenomenon ever in human history. So of course they are going to respect these things. Of course they're going to take it seriously. And to get back to really what you were asking, part of recognizing and accepting that you've lost the battle is recognizing and respecting the rituals of this culture.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Is that clear?
Yeah. And the breakdancing thing, you actually managed a breakdance crew for a while.
Well, the New York City Breakers, you know, they were second to Rocksteady Crew, or the most famous crew in the world. I mean, we danced for kings and queens, presidents more than once, danced all over, you know, the world, South America, North America, Europe. It was early in the game, so we didn't get to Africa or Asia. It wasn't happening yet there. But, you know, thankfully now Rocksteady Crew is doing it. They're going all over the world. And props to Rocksteady. You know?
So you weren't a b-boy yourself, or at least not of the caliber of the people you managed.
What happened was I don't know how, I mean, it's a bit long to tell. I'll just try to do it quickly. You know, I had the first hip-hop club called Negril. I mean,
It should be noted by our listeners probably won't know this, attended by a then probably college age or maybe younger Rick Rubin.
Oh, yeah.
He's standing out there.
Yeah. I didn't meet Rick at the time. I didn't know him. I was the big cheese at the time, you know? what had happened was, I mean, you had much earlier than Negril, you had clubs uptown like The Fever, which were some of the pioneering rap clubs. But see, to me, hip-hop is not rap. Rap is an element of hip-hop. Rap is rap. Rap, turntablism, DJing, b-boying, aerosol art, to me, that's what makes hip-hop. So, you know, The Fever was an early rap club. But I would argue this with anybody, that the first true hip-hop club, when you're talking about all the elements, was Negril. That's where I presented at the invitation of Rooza Blue, whose night it was. She saw this event that I put on at the behest and the request of Malcolm McLaren to open up for his band Bow Wow Wow at the Ritz in New York City, September 15th, 1981. I put together an all hip hop review. Bambada, Jazzy J, Ike C on the mic, Rocksteady Crew rocking the floor, my film Catch a Beat, which was the first hip-hop short film, Kel One doing graffiti, who's Debbie Mazar's boyfriend at the time. And I put on this review, which arguably was the first time all the elements of hip-hop were put together on stage in front of a paying audience. Rooza Blue saw the show, asked me to bring it to Negril. I brought that whole show intact. Before even my TV, even my film, and had it set up at Negril, and it was performing there, and it was like the first hip hop. When you talk about hip hop in terms of all as a multifaceted culture, it was the first hip hop nightclub in the world.
Rap Genius.
And you know, if I'm wrong, okay, but I think I'm right about that. I forgot what the question.
No,
was.
That's great.
Creating Rock New York City Breakers.
Yeah, but Breakers. Yeah, about you know getting that together and. I wanted to just stay on breakdancing for a second. Sure. I was born in 77. Okay. So I remember, you know, grammar school breaking as a fad, making its way out to the, you know, suburban New Jersey even,
sure.
You know, right around, I guess, this, you know, maybe it was like 6 or 7
right.
when this was really happening. And I was curious, as someone who was sort of at the epicenter of breaking, you know, as a phenomenon and then... a little later, maybe as a fad, like what it was like to see that.
Well, it was amazing. I mean, I can remember hearing about this uptown culture. Well, first I have to say, I have to thank Fab Five Freddy, number one, for being my mentor, if you will, the person who introduced me to uptown culture. And I'm not going to say hip hop because, again, we didn't use that term, hip hop. I met Fab Five Freddy in the winter of 1979, perhaps February 1979. I was working at Chemical Bank, Wall Street banker, junior banker, just got out of college, hanging out with my boy Stan Peskett, an English artist who was a bit older than me, and I knew him from California, and he lived in New York for many years already. So on the weekends, I would hang out with him, smoke joints, and just talk about art and create art events and whatever. And I read a little blurb in the Village Voice about the Fab Five. And the Fab Five was a graffiti collective.
Lee
Quiones, yeah. Slave, Mono, forgot some of the other names of some of the other artists. And Fab Five Freddy, who had joined them a little bit later near the end of their run. And was really a good hustler and knew how to talk to the media, knew how to get their name out there. And he had gotten a little blurb in the Village Voice basically saying the Fab Five is available to show up at your residency or your place of business and do some giant graffiti burners for a fee. And that's really way ahead of its time. I mean, this is like 79. They're already talking about bringing graffiti art inside and on walls for a residency and for a business. That was really early on. They were really thinking, Freddie and the Fab Five were thinking really ahead. Not a lot of graffiti artists were thinking about that.
Right. Even by 2 years later with a movie you're involved in, Downtown 81, that kind of thing would be captured on film, right? There's the scene where they're kind of doing, presumably a for-hire, Freddie and Lee are doing a presumably for-hire burner outside a club.
Exactly.
So by that point, it was something people recognized. But when he started doing it...
I'll tell you, I don't think anybody, well, very few people, no one I had ever heard of, were thinking about taking graffiti to the next step before the Fab Five and Fab Five Freddy. So I see this blurb, and there's a phone number. Call Fred Brathwaite, and I call him up, and I introduce myself, and I say, hey, you know, this sounds really fascinating. See, this was a time in New York, late 70s, early 80s. It was a very exciting time. And it was a time that you just, whatever creative impulse that struck you, you just acted on it. You saw someone's name and number, you called them up. If you thought something exciting could come of it, or you thought something creative would happen, or just even mentally stimulating by getting in contact with this person or meeting somebody at a club or a laundromat and striking up a conversation and finding things in common and maybe starting a band or maybe, you know, creating a these are the things that we did in New York without thinking about money, without thinking about any of these things. So I called him up and I said, hey, why don't you come and hang out with Stan and I? There was no reason for it. There was no ulterior motive. And he was like, yeah, sure. So he came over. And we started hanging out. Now the three of us are smoking joints and talking art and talking about like, and Stan Peskett being from the Royal College of Art and being, you know, maybe 8 or 9 years older than us was giving us an education. And I'm 5 years older than Freddie. And Freddie's from New York, a real New Yorker. And at that time in his life, he hadn't really, you know, traveled the world like I had or like the way Stan had. And so we're all sharing and he's telling us about his world in Brooklyn and about the world uptown. And we're sharing about our world, and we get to this place where we're like, why don't we put on a party, an event? And we did, and it was called the Canal Zone Party. And the point of the Canal Zone was to introduce the downtown art scene to these uptown graffiti artists that Freddie was kind of representing. And at that point, he already had a foot in each world. He was already part of the downtown scene because he was one of the cameramen for Glenn O'Brien's TV party. So he was already hip to the downtown scene. And I think by this point, he might have already been introduced to Debbie Harry and to Chris Stein of Blondie. And his other foot was in the uptown scene of graffiti. And, and, and what was going on with rap and whatnot. So I don't know anything about this, and he turns me on to this. He really didn't turn me on to anyone specific other than the Fab Five. I met Lee Kionis through him, et cetera, et cetera. But he said, you know, hey, check out what this person does. There's going to be this event, and this is what this is interesting. I think he was involved in this too. Henry Chalfant put on Henry Chalfant put on an event in the Lower East Side. I think this was years after this now, in maybe in like 1980 or 81, put on an event that he called Graffiti Rock. Called Graffiti Rock. And it was going to be this event in a community center that had, I think, Rocksteady Crew dancing, and it had some rappers and some DJs. It was Graffiti. And I wanted to go see it. This was going to be one of my first things that I was going to be introduced to this new culture. And by the time I got there, it never came off because the Ball Busters had some beef, I think, with Rocksteady Crew, and they came to destroy the party. They wouldn't let anyone in. No one could get out. It was like a big scene. And a lot of things like that happened back in those days. So I go there, and like I got there, and people's shoes were left in the street having run away. People had let run out of their shoes. I remember seeing, like, what are these shoes in the street? And I met this crew, the IBM crew, Incredible Breakmasters, a crew from Upper Manhattan, a b-boy, breakdancers.
And for our listeners to whom this is unthinkable now, Upper Manhattan in those days was not the sort of ritzy area that,
it was, you know, rough.
The UES was very, very different.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see, Riverside Drive and West Side, Riverside Drive and those streets around, those avenues around there, West End Avenue, Riverside Drive, even above the 60s and 70s was just mad ghetto. That was all regentrified. They moved out all the Puerto Ricans from the Upper West Side, and you know, a lot of whites moved back in that neighborhood. It's a really interesting thing. You know, in the beginning it was white before the Puerto Ricans moved in large numbers. So neighborhoods in New York have come and gone in so many different ways. But anyway, they were from that neighborhood. And I said, well, are you guys breakdancers? I'd heard about this. Breakdancers spin on their heads. I'm like, wow, that's amazing. I have to see this. And they said, yeah, that's what we're breakdancers. I said, well, can you spin on your head? And we're outside of the event. Again, it was all over with. And by that point, nothing had really even popped off. The event didn't even happen. And they were like, well, we're not going to spin on our heads on the sidewalk. I said, well, can I see you do this? I mean, where can I? And we've exchanged numbers and information. And I eventually got to see them dance and became their manager, got them gigs and whatnot. But I want to backtrack just really quickly. Years later, when I put together Graffiti Rock, I owe a debt of gratitude to Henry Chalfant for being so generous as to not, you know, having beef with me about the name. When I went and used that name, Graffiti Rock, I honestly, believe me, everybody out there, I have no qualms. I'm one of the more, I like to think of myself as one of the more creative people that I know and don't need to bite other people's ideas or names or whatever. And unconsciously, I did. I used Graffiti Rock from that memory, not remembering that it was someone else's. I just thought I thought of it at the time. But I owe Henry Chalfant, which tells you so much about Henry Chalfant, how mellow and cool he is. He never beefed with me. He never cared, really, or at least he never said anything. And I owe him a debt of gratitude that he let me use that name, Graffiti Rock. And it wasn't over until years after I made Graffiti Rock and put it on the air and forgot about it because it never really made it. And I had to move on with my life and went to film school and did all these different things, that somebody said, you know, that was Henry Chalfant's name of his event. And I'm like, wow, it really, that's true. I found the little blurb. I thought, oh my God, I used his name. So I'm guilty as charged. And thank you, Henry, for letting me use it.
Yeah. So this crew of yours eventually morphed
IBM,
into the Breakers.
I started getting them gigs, and I started I got them gigs. I had them, my old band that I was involved in, which is how I became really, my baptism into art, into theater, was the Tubes from San Francisco. And when they came to New York in the early 80s, I had, must have been 81, I had IBM dance during White Punks on Dope. Anybody who knows the Tubes, they know that's this kind of finale to their show when they have like this whole cast of thousands on stage. And actually IBM, who were some of the ringers for the Rocksteady Crew's battle of the Dynamic Breakers or Dynamic Rockers in the at the infamous Lincoln Center battle that happened in the summer of 81, I knew the IBM crew. They said, come to this battle we're going to be involved in. And that's how I met Rocksteady Crew. And I became their unofficial manager and agent for about a year or so. So through IBM, I met Rocksteady Crew, and the rest is kind of history.
That's great. And but the I wanted to ask something very specific about the Breakers and them blowing up, which was I was watching like some TV segment, some like TV news segment about the Breakers, and it was by and large flattering, you know, portraits of their personalities, you know, interviews with their mothers and shots of them dancing on the street. But there was also a pretty racist element to a lot of the coverage. I think they even called it, I think they called the dancing like ragged and naive at one point.
Was it one of those magazine shows?
Yeah. So I was just curious about this, like dealing with non-hip hop audiences and how you either like dealt with this sort of like racial overtones or sometimes maybe not, maybe, you know, more explicit.
I suppose it was kind of, it had a racist undertone or overtone to it. What you say instantly reminds me of, and this never happened overseas, but it definitely happened here. There were a number of times in which New York City Breakers, who were a big part of the Beat Street film, when we went on a Beat Street tour, I can remember us doing news shows. We'd be on local news stations and, you know, like 5 o'clock news or whatever, and they'd need a little, you know, novelty news or whatever, and they'd have us on, and it happened so many times. I was shocked the first time it happened. One of the newscasters, who inevitably would be like a white guy, whatever, youngish to middle age, we would do a performance. They would interview us, and then inevitably, he would try to break dance. And it was just like, oh no, this is too painful. And it was like, watch me try to do this. And ha ha ha, aren't I silly and funny? It was like, no, 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 you're not supposed to do that. I mean, if you had, you know, some famous concert violinist on, would you then try to take the violin and make an idiot of yourself playing the violin? You wouldn't do that. And but they would do that with the dancers. And it was like a major diss. And it happened like 3 or 4 times. And it was just like, you on one hand, you couldn't refuse the exposure. You needed the exposure. On the other hand, that was the price of that exposure. And you just thought, like, you know, what assholes, you know? And, like, we'd always stand there and roll our eyes while they were doing that. They'd say, oh, teach us how to... I can remember that's happening, too, with DJs. I can remember TV things where Jazzy J would have to teach some news reporter how to scratch. And it was just... It was kind of humiliating. I don't know. I suppose it's racist, but it's tone deaf in terms of cultural awareness, for sure. Rap Genius.
You had one final thought about breaking, I believe.
Well, three.
Three final thoughts.
Three final thoughts. One is that this is kind of weird and strange, and I think a lot of people may, I don't know how they're going to take this. And again, this is just my opinion, but I've had this verified by many people uptown who grew up in uptown culture, that the downtown impresarios like myself, Charlie Ahern and Marty Cooper and Henry Chalfant and Fat Five Freddy, whatever, as we're bringing the culture downtown and presenting it to our community, to the rest of New York City, to the rest of the world vis-a-vis the press, we were naively creating a culture that didn't exist. And by that I mean, of course the DJs were doing their thing, and of course the B-boys were doing their thing, and the rappers and the graffiti artists, etc., way before we ever got involved. But they weren't doing it together under one umbrella. We sort of thought they were. we sort of assumed that they were. I mean, you know, we went uptown and this was going on, that was going on within a certain vicinity. So this must be like a cohesive culture. It wasn't. The idea that B-boys were in crews that had graffiti artists who were representing them and the DJ, that's bullshit. It didn't work. That didn't happen. We thought it did. So we put together this culture and presented it naively thinking we were just kind of tightening it up a little bit and brushing it off a little bit and getting it all together and presenting it to our audience. And the whole time, we didn't realize that all these artists were saying, well, we're not going to say anything to Michael or to Freddie or whatever, but we don't know these guys. We don't know these rappers. We don't know these aerosol artists. We don't know these dancers. We wouldn't normally hang out with them. But since we're getting paid and this is working out and we got a new audience, what the hell? Let's do it. And as an aside to that point, in terms of the new audience and getting paid, Bambaataa and Jazzy J, and I'm going off on tangents here, but Bambaataa and Jazzy J with Ikey C and a lot of the Zulu crew, they had already, before I had ever met them, in the mid-70s and on, had already been putting on these park jams. That's what hip-hop was called back in the day. They had already been putting on these park jams that were very successful. Who was their audience? They only had one audience. Teenagers, and mostly teenage boys. Why? Mostly black, some Puerto Rican, some whites, up in the Bronx. It was a mixed area. Why was it teenage boys? And mainly that group, junior high? Because high school and above, when they went out to party, they went downtown, wore hard shoes so they can get into clubs, bring a girlfriend, impress her, and get laid. Kids who were younger, who didn't have the money, who didn't have hard shoes, who had sneakers, their only real party scene was Bambaataa and Kool Herc and Grandmaster Flash's outdoor jams. They were the lion's share of that audience, and they were the vanguard of what would become hip-hop culture. Trust me. Because everybody, if you went uptown during those days, late 70s, early 80s, if you went back in time, you think everyone was doing hip-hop? Bullshit. People would be saying, I don't want to go to that hippie hip-hop bullshit. I want to go downtown and see, like, the Gap Band. Funkadelic, Keith Sweat. I mean, that's what I want to see. Luther Vandross. Sometimes what I'd call Jerry Curl music. What Bam was spinning was old stuff from the 60s and 70s that these young kids were getting turned on to James Brown, getting turned on to these wild other eclectic things like the soundtrack, I mean, the theme song to I Dream a Genie or the Mary Mary by the Monkees. That's a whole other issue. But they had been doing this in the later 70s, mid to later 70s, and the audiences were dying down, and they started doing it in the parks and in New Jersey and in Connecticut, in urban areas in Jersey and Connecticut. And by the time I met them, that had been dying down. And Jazzy J and Bambaataa were hanging up their turntables and looking to get normal jobs. And Jazzy J, when I started bringing him downtown, and when Freddie started bringing them downtown, Jazzy pulled me aside and said, man, thank God for you and everybody else, because if it wasn't for you guys bringing us downtown and introducing us to this new punk rock, new wave audience, we were having to change our lifestyle. We were having to like hang up our turntables and find normal, regular jobs. So people need to know that. And if you don't believe me, ask Jazzy J. I'm not making this up.
Yeah. Well, Bam, jumping ahead a few years to when you did Graffiti Rock, which, you know, we'll talk about in depth in a few minutes, but was the first hip-hop television show. Bam had a role in that, right?
Which show was
it? In Graffiti Rock.
Oh, my show. Yeah. Bambaataa was a good friend of mine by this point. You know, I'd already gotten him gigs. Done an interview of him in East Village High. So we were friends. We hung out. I'd go up to visit him in the Bronx. He'd come downtown to visit me. As I was learning more and more about this culture. And so I wanted him to be the DJ of Graffiti Rock, naturally. And if not him, Jazzy J. And so, And I wanted him to be a consultant on the show, an associate producer. And he was. And he's credited on...
Right,
on
his credit is... I forget the exact
I think
thing.
It's associate
musical
producer
something.
Or yeah. musical consultant, whatever. Yeah, I don't like remember that. What it is, actually.
Yeah.
Wow, I never thought of that. I forgot that. And I'm really proud now that his name is on my TV show. That's cool. So he said, no, I want one of my young Zulu Nation up-and-coming DJs. And so he gave me Jimmy Jazz to be the DJ for Graffiti Rock. And so anyway, that's what you were alluding to or referring to. And he actually turned me on to Brim. I could have had a number of different, you know, DJs or a number of different graffiti artists, but the graffiti artist and DJ, that was Bambaataa's consultation. So Zulu Nation has DNA in graffiti rock.
Yeah, and it's musical consultant was his title
right.
on the credits. I just
right.
rewatched it.
But he definitely suggested Brim, too, to do the graffiti.
Yeah. And another thing I rewatched before.
I don't want to forget about the whole the B-boys thing that I was going to say.
Oh, okay, sure.
Well, one was I just explained.
Yeah.
The second is that a lot that at a certain point in the history of rap and hip hop, I suppose that this kind of forcing these cultures together, the rappers, the DJs. The B-boys, whatever, in this artificial way that we downtown empresarios did, it kind of started to fray. It kind of started to pull back apart again naturally in a way that people like Russell Simmons, you know, promoters, producers, entrepreneurs, as time went on, the whole rap game started to distance themselves from this idea of rap being, started to distance themselves from this idea that rap was somehow an integral part of b-boying, an integral part of graffiti art. And I think that these guys, these geniuses of rap, obviously, started to see that, hey, wait a second, we don't need to be too closely associated to b-boys and to graffiti artists and all that. There's no money in that. We need to focus on the music, and the music alone. And even the DJs got kicked to the curb in this thing that happened in the later 80s.
I was to say, you see that happening, you know, even in the names of groups, you know, the DJs would be included in the names of groups
exactly.
up until about, I don't know, 88, 89, and then it kind of started disappearing.
And then you started to see that disappear.
Yeah.
But early on, you know, like the great pioneers of rap, like Curtis Blow, his shows had graffiti art. His shows had break dancers. His shows had the DJs. I mean, he was like that classic hip-hop thing that maybe was this weird construct, this artificial construct that we downtowners put together. But very soon on, that started to fall apart. And people like Russell Simmons were like, no. We're not going to be playing that. This is just going to be about rap and about... And the only time that some of these DJs are involved is if they have the skills as producers. But what I really wanted to say is, all that is fair enough, and I understand it, but by turning their back on the other elements of uptown culture, I think was unfortunate. And I think that they all owe a great, even today with the Swiss Beats and with, you know, the Lil Wayne's and even modern hip hop artists and rap artists owe a debt of gratitude to the pioneers and to the B-boy pioneers, to the breakdancers, to the Crazy Legs and to the Mr. Waves and to the Actions and to, you know, the Ken Swifts and to the Flip Rocks and Little Leps of the world. They owed a debt of gratitude because here's what's interesting and here's what your listeners need to know. Breakdancing and B-boying and B-boys were the lost leaders of hip-hop. They broke down the doors. They were the ones television producers were like, oh my God, I got to know about this culture. People spinning on their heads. They were like, we've got to know about this. We've got to get this on this TV show. And in conjunction with that, we'll get the rappers who rap to these breakdancers and the DJs that DJ to these breakdancers. And yeah, we'll get the graffiti art because that can be a nice, you know, background thing. But we got to get the breakdancers on the TV show. And it was the breakdancers that were the lost leaders of hip hop. They're the ones who kicked down the doors that created this audience. So you should recognize that and you should like give a little like props.
Yeah. That's had never thought about that. That's, I mean,
that's
makes,
what I wanted to
sense.
Say.
I wanted to ask something crazy because I was rewatching this just last night, Downtown 81. I wanted to talk about, so the scene in it that, well, first I was curious about your involvement in it, both in its initial incarnation and its, you know, recent reissue. Mm-hmm. And then also in particular about the crazy scene that you actually have with Basquiat where you're, you know, maybe kidnapped and tied up, although it's a little, the film leaves it a little bit unclear,
yeah,
as most things in that film are, to be fair. So if you talk a little bit about that film, what it was, your involvement in it, and then the scene.
Sure. Well, I believe that they started shooting that film in 1980. Jean was in, we had already started, that was at the height of Grey. Jean-Michel Basquiat met me and Fat Five Freddy the same night at Canal Zone Party. And that night, Jean and I started the band. It wasn't necessarily called Grey at the time, but we started making music, sounds, noise, all kinds of things. And we put this band together, and it was myself, Jean-Michel Basquiat, Wayne Clifford, Nick Taylor. At a point, there was Shannon Dawson was in the band, and at a certain point, Vincent Gallo was in the band.
I should note also for our listeners that I know for a fact that at least one session you had, you'd mentioned Debbie Mazur earlier, that she was playing, I think it was clarinet, and at least one session.
I don't think Debbie played a session in Grey necessarily, but Debbie Mazur in the early days of the Mud Club scene, and she was just a baby. I mean, she was the youngest kid who... She'd show up in the Mud Club at 14 to 15 years old. And I don't know how she got in, but that was the Mud Club was like that. She just took herself so seriously, and she looked so good, and she was so cute. But she always showed up with a saxophone. And she would play the saxophone, and I guess that's how she got into the clubs. I don't remember her ever jamming with Grey, but she might have.
Okay.
She might have. I don't remember that.
But so Downtown 81.
So Downtown 81 was being shot at the height of Grey. Performing all over the downtown scene. We'd performed already by this point at CBGB's and the Mud Club and really great name places, Tier 3, Hurrah's. And Glenn O'Brien and Mary Paul and Ado, who were all like downtown royalty on the scene. Glenn O'Brien had already been working with Warhol, and Ado was a Swiss-Italian photographer, and Mary Paul was a downtown scenester who I had even met years before. I tried to pick her up when she was a customer of mine when I was working at the bank. The three of them got together to make this film, and Danny Rosen was going to be the star of the film, and he didn't want to be the star. And the story was about an artist who was... was on the verge of blowing up, you know, downtown artist who was on the verge of blowing up and making it into the gallery scene. And they first wanted Danny Rosen, and for whatever reason, Danny didn't refuse to do it, didn't work out on some level. And the next choice was Basquiat. And so Jean was like cool about it. And Jean, you have to understand, and I called Basquiat, was friends of Jean, FOBs, friends of Basquiat, we always called him Jean. Jean's singular focus, because he already had the chops to be a great painter, and he already always was a great artist. So his next singular focus was to become a famous artist. So anything that he could do that would facilitate that, he did. And so being the star of a downtown film sounded like a pretty good idea. And so, but he was like almost impossible. I mean, Jean was just impossible to work with at times. They'd show up at wherever he was staying, and he'd be asleep, you know, 5 a.m, and they'd have to start shooting early on, and he'd be like, you know, they'd have to like wake him up, and he was hard to work with on that shoot. But the amazing thing about Jean just showed what a genius he was, what a realized being he was. He was just great at anything and everything he did, and he was a great actor in that film. I mean, imagine if the film had like a stronger storyline and with Jean, his acting, it could have been even a greater film, but it is a great document of that time, and I'm really proud to have been part of it. I really, what frustrates me about that film is I really wish that Gray, like all the other bands that were in their DNA, and
had a huge
I wish that we had had like a scene where we performed live. I don't know why we didn't get to perform live in the film, but we didn't. So
I thought I saw a cameo from John Lurie in there for a second. Was he in?
No, John Lurie wasn't in that film, I don't think. He certainly didn't play. He might be on the soundtrack.
Okay.
I don't remember him in that film. That's weird too that John Lurie's not in there.
Yeah.
But
seeing,
but I am in the film as a bandmate of Jean's who is tied up by some thieves who break into our rehearsal studio to steal all of our instruments. They tie me up and steal all of our instruments, and Jean shows up ready for rehearsal, and there I am tied up, and he takes the gag off my mouth. And I'm trying to convince him that we were robbed and we need to do something about it and to untie me. And he doesn't believe me. He thinks maybe it's an inside job and I'm somehow responsible. And so he never unties me. And he leaves me there going, Jean, what are you doing leaving me tied up? You know, and it was a cool moment. I'm kind of proud of that moment. I sort of forget about it. And people remind me of it. And I'm like, wow, I was kind of in this really important document. I'll tell you what my reaction to what I singularly love about this film, above and beyond Basquiat that I was involved in, the Schnabel's film Basquiat, which I was the original screenwriter to that film. The documentary of that Tamara Davis did, Radiant Child, which is a brilliant documentary. But even above and beyond those two films, what Downtown 81 has, just for a fleeting moment, a couple of moments in the film, you see Jean writing. You see him tagging in the Countess's book, Daniela Morera, my good friend who I love very much. She played the Countess, the Italian Countess. He picks up this book while she's out of the room and he draws in it. You can see this awkward, childlike, like tortured kind of way that he just draws this face and writes Aaron, and it really captures the way Jean drew and the way Jean painted like no other film I've ever seen. It really looks like Jean. So that film is really important, and you should watch that film just to see him drawing this face in the book, just to see the way he holds his hand. It's so charming, and it so captures his voice and his style and his signature. Yeah.
And unfortunately, when you do see the film, you'll notice all the dialogue has been replaced.
Right.
Now former guest and good friend of the show, Saul Williams, actually did Jean's voice.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I didn't know. I forgot about that. I didn't forget that had happened. I just forgot the name of the person that did. I don't think I knew Saul very well.
Did you? It sounded like your voice.
I dubbed my own voice.
Yeah.
What had happened was it was that they got the money from some Italian social club.
Upset about that.
Yeah, dodgy kind of like organized kind of whatever. Yeah.
In the film business, come on.
Yeah, I don't know who they were, but some nefarious group were the ones that put the money up for that film. And somehow the soundtrack was lost or held for hostage or something. I don't know the whole story, but whatever the story was, they lost the soundtrack. They had all the footage. Mary Paul and Glenn had all the footage, but they lost the soundtrack. And they decided at a certain point, what are we doing? This is great stuff. The only thing stopping us from putting it out is to re-record the soundtrack. You know, just do the music again. That wasn't difficult. And then they'd have to get people to come in and dub, you know, all their lines. Of course, they'd have to get someone to dub Jean's line. And he did a pretty good job, I thought. And that's what they did. I don't know what year that was, in the 2000s,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
And they put the film back together again. And it's this great document. And kudos to Glenn O'Brien and Mary Paul for doing that. It was an amazing feat. And now it's something that people can see, you know?
Yeah. And the funny thing that film captures about the downtown scene is like how almost kind of like avant-garde and sort of free jazz influenced a lot of the music was.
Yeah, I mean, it does capture that scene and about and some of the new wave and no wave music. That's why Gray would have been so great in that film, because we would have done one of our well, we actually recorded the song Drum Mode for that film, and I think you fans of Rap Genius are going to have that access to Drum Mode soon enough, and you'll see that it's a very avant-garde noise sound, but a beautiful piece of music inspired by Stockhausen, inspired by John Cage. And that song was meant for the film. We probably would have played that live for the film, and that would have really rounded out, because there's nothing like that in the film, certainly not played live. But DNA is pretty raw, pretty funky, and then you had a number of other bands, a Japanese band, the Plastic.
Yeah.
I forget what they were called.
I remember. Yeah, well, you've had quite a you know, even just film and television career, obviously, had something to do with Beat Street.
Yeah, I mean, I was associate producer on Beat Street. I was asked by Harry Belafonte and David Picker to the way I became introduced was that to that was through Stephen Hager, who's a good friend of mine and was, to me, the ultimate hip-hop journalist at the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was the number one hip-hop journalist. And he wrote the screenplay that was the screenplay to the film Beat Street, probably got rewritten and stepped on a number of times, just the way that my script, Basquiat, was stepped on and rewritten, whatever. But I knew Steven, so Steven knew me as a hip-hop impresario and said, well, you should definitely, he knew David Picker and Harry Belafonte and introduced me to them as someone who could really help with getting these artists involved in the film. And I did. The film was what it was. I mean,
I was going to ask about that. I feel like there are, you know, it was very important to a lot of people, and a lot of people, right, you know, love it. But at the same time, there's also kind of this overtone of like, was it Hollywood, you know, a Hollywoodization of this, you know, at this point, new culture? Or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it really, really was. And there are some really great things about it. For example, the truly authentic things about it, the battle between Rocksteady Crew and the New York City Breakers, I mean, that wasn't even staged at all. They asked me, like, how should they shoot it? And I said, listen, these guys are really at each other's throats now. You know, there's, and you're never going to get a chance to shoot it and then say, okay, cut, let's reposition this and change the lighting to get it from another angle. That's never going to happen. You need to shoot it in one take. And the way that I suggested that they set up five cameras and light it in a way that five cameras could effectively shoot this, which made it really like butter to cut together. And that's what they did. And so you had a real battle that wasn't repeated. All those shots are one time, but just from five different cameras. And I think it's one of the most amazing battles on film. And so that was a really authentic moment. But yeah, I mean, you know, there was a lot of cringing for me where it was like, oh my God, I thought we were gonna have this amazing opportunity to really show this culture, and it was really unfortunately in many ways bastardized by Hollywood. You know, they had like a big Hollywood production designer who, I forget her name now, but she was like a genius production designer. She had done some amazing period films. Brilliant things. I think she did something really like major, like some major film I really liked. And then, but she took that sensibility into the hip hop world, and it just didn't work. And it just looked corny and forced. And the story, and I mean, bringing them to the ballet, and oh, it's just like, oh, why are we doing this? The life uptown was enough. You don't need to like incorporate ballet and modern dance and all these crazy things that happened in the film. But they thought that they needed that in order to make it work. And that's a shame. And I'll tell you something. Unfortunately, there are elements of graffiti rock that I was guilty of that too. I mean, I had my vision of what it was. And my backer said, well, we'll never get it on the air if we don't have this and this and this and that. And it was a huge, jiu-jitsu wrestling match between like what I wanted and what I had to succumb to that... you know, I'm not particularly proud of some of the things, some of the concessions that I had to make, but I had to make concessions too. And you'll see the difference between when you pledge and you get this
we'll get to that in just a minute.
You'll see the things, the footage and the hip hop shows that I produced back in 2 years before I made Graffiti Rock. You'll see the way I was approaching the culture. You'll see the way I was shooting it and staging it. That's like authentic to the culture. And then you compare that to Graffiti Rock, you'll see I had to make certain concessions just to get it on the air. But I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I got it on the air. But, you know, these are things that I had to do. I'd like to think that I didn't quite, you know, bend over backwards as far as Beat Street did. But I can understand that then. I don't know the answer to that. It was early in the culture. It was a time when the world wasn't ready for it. And we had to make concessions. Like, not like you had to make when Yo MTV Raps didn't have to make those concessions. And now, today, nobody has to make those concessions. But we did. So, sue me.
So, we're finally arriving at Graffiti Rock, which is maybe the thing you're best known for.
Yeah,
which was a one episode of a television show that was, I think, arguably one of the first, maybe the first hip-hop television show, except for maybe some things you did on New York cable, New York Public Access few years before. That, you know, had dances and pop artists and rappers. And it was kind of like I guess, American Bandstand or Soul Train style show. But for hip hop.
Right.
And so I was wondering if you maybe kind of take us through, you know, going from doing public access stuff to this idea of like, oh, I'm going to do a big show with, you know, Run DMC and Kool Moe Dee on it.
Sure. Well, the real genesis of Graffiti Rock has to start with Negril. You know, I'm partnered with Kool Lady Blue, and we're doing these every Thursday night in 1981 hip hop events downtown in a club that was on Second Avenue between 11th and 12th Streets. And as she's seen this becoming bigger and bigger in a nightclub scenario, because Negril was a tiny little club, even though we did have Kool Herc and Bambaataa and Grand Wizard Theodore and Fat Five Freddy and Futura and Cold Crush Brothers and Rocksteady Crew and New York City Breakers and Floor Masters. And I mean, we had some major people performing there for primarily a downtown audience.
For our listeners who are in New York City, that's that place on 2nd Avenue just below 14th Street where there's a movie theater.
There's a movie theater there, yep, on the west side of 2nd Avenue, yeah. Exactly. And it was a downstairs spot. And that movie theater has a downstairs thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, anyway. So even though we had these amazing names with Phase 2 doing the flyers, I mean, the legendary graph artist, aerosol artist Phase 2 doing the flyers. It was an amazing time. But the club was kind of small, and it was for a small audience. And yes, we were getting press, and yes, we were getting BBC documentary filmmakers coming, and we were really spreading things around the country and around the world from Negril. But Blue was smart to see that we could do this in a bigger club, and I was kind of stuck more on Negril. And so she moved it. She invited me to be part of it, and I refused, stupidly. She moved it to Roxy's, which is a much bigger venue. And I was seeing myself going into, she's, okay, you're going to a bigger venue, nightclub venue. I don't want to go down that road. I want to go down the road of even bigger than that. I want to go to TV. And I started plotting back then in 81, how can I get this culture onto TV? I'm thinking that if I get this on TV, it's going to really, and again, going back to this point about educating people and using these educational tools to turn people onto hip hop culture, I'm thinking that television would be the 800-pound gorilla in the room in terms of like taking it to the next level. You can't do bigger than TV. And so I'm thinking, how can this happen? And first step, after kind of Negril dissipates and Roxy blows up, I'm thinking, okay, what if I start shooting this and I was already shooting, as a matter of fact, I was already shooting this on Super 8 and video in 1980 without even thinking why. But I collected all this, and I actually have more hip-hop footage, old-school hip-hop footage, than anyone in the world. I just do, because I just was shooting it back then. And I started, and then I saw this opportunity to have your own program on public access in Manhattan and parts of the Bronx and parts of other parts of New York City. It was a really weird, spotty audience for cable. And it was before they were numbers the way they are today. It was like letters, like Channel J, Channel K. It would show in certain parts of Brooklyn and certain parts of Manhattan. And it was really weird. And but I decided, okay, I'm going to apply for one of these shows, and I got one. And I started putting together these shows. First one was called On Beat TV. And then I had another show called TV New York. And they were both pretty much hip-hop TV shows. Again, before we even used that term. And I had I kind of helped discover and had on that show Dougie Fresh. I had my bandmate now, Nick Taylor, who was DJ High Priest back then, who was to me the first white hip-hop DJ. First white hip was DJ High Priest, Nick Taylor. He was on the show. I had Jazzy Joyce, the first female DJ. I had Phase 2 rapping. I had Fab Five Freddy rapping. I had New York City Breakers. I had Futura. I had a lot of people from the scene, the downtown scene, and some people from the uptown scene on my various hip-hop TV shows. But they're like broadcasting to maybe like 15, 20,000 people max on cable, whoever had cable, you know, local access. So I'm doing that, and I'm thinking, okay, this is getting boring because I can't advertise. And there's no way to make revenue so that I can like take this to another level. And I'm thinking, I've got to take this to another level. And I met this guy, Paul McCraven. He was the lawyer for New Edition, a Boston black guy from an attorney, black attorney from Boston, where New Edition was from. And I met him on the scene downtown, and I was talking, and he knew that I was doing these TV shows, and he was the one who kind of made me believe, or he was the first step in introducing me to people who could really finance this. He knew people who were backing the label that was putting out New Edition. And they were these two executives. Steve Mamishian was one of them, who were Payne Weber executives. And the other guy was, forget his name now, I'm really sorry, some Bill Johnson or something. Bob Johnson, I think, was another Payne Weber executive. And I put together a proposal and brought it to these guys and said, I want to do a hip-hop TV show. And you have to remember, this is early on in the game. And when I presented it to them, it was probably no later than in late 82. It was 1982 when I was doing all this stuff. And so these were really forward-thinking people. And they were like, okay, this sounds like a good idea. And what's instrumental about this was that this was before the Reagan administration and a Republican Congress voted to eliminate the ability for individual investors to invest in films and TV and other creative ventures and get a giant tax write-off. The only explanation I can make is that Reagan, which I can believe, and his ilk in the Republican Party sought to cripple, hobble creativity or the support of the creative ventures. They were looking to hobble the NEA, et cetera, you know, National Endowment of the Arts, et cetera. And we got right under the wire to where we could get investors to invest. We got like 15, 20 investors to invest, not rich people, $10,000 each. And they got it off their taxes. And they were like, okay, it sounds like a viable investment. They threw Steve Mamishian and his partner, we got the money together to find a space. It was up in the upper in Spanish Harlem, off Madison Avenue. I think it was like 106th Street. It was like a studio, a TV studio, still there, right near the Graffiti Wall of Fame up there on the Upper East Side. You know, I wrote a script. Obviously, I pre-produced. You know, we auditioned different directors. Interesting stories about that. Things I'd never really told anybody before. There was this TV director who, back in the 60s and early 70s, had put together his own TV show. And people from New York who were old enough would know. It was a soul TV show, local show. And he was a black director. I don't know if he created it. I think it might have been his creation, but he definitely directed it. It was like a dance, local dance show. And I really wanted him to direct it. And when I auditioned him, he was clearly addicted to something. I think it was cocaine. And he was so frazzled that my heart was broken, but I couldn't hire him. I just lost confidence. I remember his ultra beautiful girlfriend who was like saying, he can do it, he can do it, you know, like hire him, it's cool. And I was just like, oh my God, this guy was obviously like half out of his mind. I couldn't do it because, you know, if I had, it would have just been, you know, I would have been responsible. I mean, I had to get somebody who I knew was responsible. We ended up hiring what's his name? He was the director who directed the segment in King of Comedy, Scorsese's film, where Robert De Niro marries Diane Abbott. Funny thing, Diane Abbott is like a good friend of mine now. When they get married in the film, on the TV show that Jerry Lewis is supposed to be the host of, the Jerry Langford show, the director of that moment, the TV director of that moment is the director of Graffiti Rock. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool that he was involved with Scorsese, so that's cool.
Yeah.
Sorry that I didn't... I used to remember his name. I forgot his name. We'll get his name in there, I guess, somehow.
Yeah, definitely.
So we got a director. We've got a location. We're going to shoot. And I knew how I wanted to set up the... You know, we got Brim, graffiti artist, to do the set. I think he misspelled rapper and spelled it raper, which I think is kind of funny. I don't know if anybody caught that. My good friend at the time, Vincent Gallo, he was like so... He, like a lot of other people from the downtown scene, myself and a lot of people, Debbie Mazar, Suzanne Malouk, Claudia Percelli, Nick Taylor, there's a lot of us downtowners, downtown kids who had really embraced hip-hop. And not just momentarily or just for certain events. I mean, we lived that and we dressed that. And Vince was that. And he loved all that stuff. And he was my assistant manager in Rocks in Graffiti and in New York City Breakers. Sometimes, I mean, we were so popular, sometimes I'd split the crew apart and I'd take half the crew to one country and he'd take the other half of the crew to another country and be the manager, be the adult. And we were like all of in our like early 20s. So while I'm producing Graffiti Rock, I'm also promoting my book and writing my book and taking some of the breakers to different parts of the world to promote Beat Street. And I needed different people to do different things. And Vince I asked Vince to organize the audience to help me get together a crew of people to be the dance crew. And even though Vince was young at the time, he was someone I knew I could depend on. He's just very super like together person, which is proven now because, you know, he's a big successful director and artist. And, you know, he just knows how to get things done. He always did. I knew I could depend on him. I you know, I had certain friends from there. You know, that was one of the things that we were that was forced on us by the producers. You know, I really wanted to have, you know, basically an all black and Puerto Rican audience and dance crew. But we couldn't do that to get the thing on the air. We had to have a mixed audience, which is cool. I certainly wanted to have white kids on the scene. But I probably would have preferred like, you know, 80%, you know, 70% black and 20% Puerto Rican and 10% white kind of crowd. And what was forced upon me was a different demographic. Okay, fine, that's cool. Here's my thinking is, I don't know if anyone's ever seen, any of you Trekkies out there, if you've ever seen the first Star Trek episode. Mr. Spock is not this calm, cool alien. He is an alien. He is half Vulcan, but he's all like excited and two battle stations. There's nothing like what he became. Obviously, they had a chance to like mold the show to get the characters right, to get it where it needed to be. I thought I was going to have that opportunity, but I never did. I thought I had the opportunity to have. I was thinking didn't even really want to be the host. I wanted to have either Fab Five Freddy, who was the host of some of my earlier hip hop shows, like On Beat TV, or I was even thinking of Mr. Magic, who was one of the first hip hop DJs from WBLS. And I thought, like, okay, we'll get this first one with me, and then you know, once we get the show, because I know it's going to happen, we're going to get different people to be part of this. You know, a couple of things. Russell Simmons was super generous, and I'll never be able to thank him enough in allowing me to have Run DMC to perform on the show. Interestingly enough, I don't know how many people know this, but Rick Rubin met Russell Simmons at the Graffiti Rock Rap Party. And Rick Rubin always says that. I'm thinking, wow, man, somebody as cool as Rick Rubin always like gives me props and shouts me out and shouts out Graffiti Rock. When he says, well, I just want everyone to know, man, I met Russell Simmons at the Graffiti Rock Rap Party. Shout outs to Rick Rubin on that.
That's great. And unfortunately, the show, you know, only lasted that one episode, but it's been incredibly influential. And, you know, people remember it and watch it to this day. And so what's happening is you are putting together a new anniversary edition of the DVD and a documentary, dipping into your vast, vast archives.
Right.
And so there's a chance for people to actually see some of this stuff that you've been talking about in the interview. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Next year is the 30th anniversary of Graffiti Rock. So I've created a Kickstarter campaign. And all you have to do is go to Kickstarter and type in Graffiti Rock, and you'll see it. I've created a Kickstarter campaign in which I'm going to, it's a $50,000 budget. That money is going primarily into creating a documentary that is called Graffiti Rock, The Untold Story, which is going to, we haven't produced it yet. That's what the money's going to be for. We're going to make a documentary film that's going to talk about the making of Graffiti Rock, the behind the scenes story. So you can, if you want to know about it, it's going to really be in this, all these stories. What it was like when Vincent Gallo had to go into the room where Run DMC were smoking spliffs, and Vince got a contact high, and through the whole episode, through the whole show, he's stoned out of his mind just from the contact high of trying to get Run DMC to perform on stage, which I think is their greatest performance, their greatest TV performance ever, is on Graffiti Rock. So on the documentary is going to be all this behind-the-scenes stories. There's going to be interviews of people like Q-Tip and Yasiin Bey, Mos Def, and all these hip-hop stars and artists who blew up in the 90s and later, who saw the show when they were teenagers and young kids, and how much it influenced them. And I want to get their take on what Graffiti Rock meant to them, because that's the audience that I was really making this show for, the 10 to 15-year-olds. You know, that was really my audience. I want to get their take. And I also want to have a real chance for me to expound upon my history and my contributions to the culture and the downtown scene's contribution to the culture. That's what that documentary is for. But also in this package is going to be a remastered version of the show. There's going to be all this, like I was talking about, footage from my TV shows and all this other footage from my vault. I'm pulling out everything. And especially Graffiti Rock, the first ever hip-hop film. It was made in 1981, short film, made in 1981. I've never released it before. Catch a Beat.
Okay.
Thank you. I've never released this film before. There have been bits and bobs, a few seconds here and there that people have seen, have been in music videos like Planet Rock, but the whole complete film has never been seen. That's going to be on this. We have gifts for pledgers that are out of this world, like New York City Breaker t-shirts, signed, autographed vinyl versions of Kumo D's remix of the New York City Breakers theme song, posters, just incredible opportunity to be credited on the documentary, on the re-release of Graffiti Rock. At certain levels, I'm going to be inviting people to come to. People are going to be able to come to New York and meet with me, have dinner with me, sit in a symposium as to how I kind of helped bring hip hop to the world, like what I did, and share with any other up and coming empresario in another part of the world with another subculture. You know, I'm really trying to share my life as an educator, as an empresario, as a historian, and all the memorabilia as much as I have. Stickers, flyers, all the documentation that went into making Graffiti Rock, the contracts, the Nielsen reports, the proposals that I told you about, yeah. All of them, copies of them, are all part of the gifts that people can get when they pledge. So I'm really like opening my heart and opening my vaults and opening my archives to people who are pledging. And you'll see when you go on Kickstarter and type in Graffiti Rock, you'll see the amazing story behind this, what you're getting, what you're pledging for. And all I can say is, like, thank you, everybody, for spreading the word, telling your friends, and pledging yourselves.
And we encourage, of course, all of our listeners to go to Kickstarter and search for Graffiti Rock and get some of these amazing historical prizes. I think anyone who listens to the show, who's listened to this interview, has an interest in hip-hop and its history, really, really should reach out for this. And thank you, Michael Holman, for coming by and sharing so much with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Rap Genius, and thank you all the Rap Genius listeners out there. It takes the fans to make a scene happen, and embrace your culture.
That was our interview with hip-hop impresario Michael Holman. Join us in 2 weeks when our guest will be Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Ron Isley. We talked to him about over a half century of music making. It's a really special interview, and I can't wait for you to hear it. If you enjoy what you hear on Outside the Lines, find us on iTunes. From there, you can subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. You can also leave us a review. The more reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get amazing guests like Michael Holman. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is created and written by Sean Sotaro, a.k.a. Same Old Sean.
And, he just knows how to get things done. He always did.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Just showed what a genius he was, what a realized being he was. He was just great at anything and everything he did.
Special research assistance for this episode comes from Bill Adler and Martin Beese.
Wall Street banker, junior banker, just got out of college.
Our music is by Psionic.
And I wanted him to be a consultant on the show, an associate producer.
Join us in 2 weeks for a chat with Mr. Biggs himself, Ron Isley. We'll see you then, Outside the Lines.
Awesome. Spread my notes out here.
Cool.
And